This is Midday Magazine for Wednesday, July 22nd. I'm Angela Denning. Budget cuts to state troopers are taking place all over Alaska. But in small southeast communities like Petersburg, it's a double whammy. That's because community jails are also taking a big hit, and the two are inextricably linked. KFSK intern Joe Sykes explains.
When you think of doing time, most people imagine something on a grand scale, like out of the film The Shawshank Redemption. But the community jails in Southeast are a little different from that.
Our jail facility here, this is our visitation room. This is our main cell block.
Kelly Swihart, who's Petersburg's chief of police, is showing me a cell block made up of two rooms lodged at the back of the Petersburg police station. He takes me into one of the cells.
There's nobody in this cell. Yeah, we have two steel bunks with some mattresses here, and also over in the corner is a combination unit of a sink and a toilet. It's pretty sparse.
The maximum stay here is 15 days at the moment. After that, an inmate will be transferred to a larger facility in Juneau or Ketchikan. The state troopers are responsible for the transportation of people from community jails. But there are no law enforcement troopers in Petersburg, and Swihart thinks the swinging cuts to the state troopers' budget will make it difficult for them to move prisoners in good time.
The chain of command at Department of Corrections and Department of Public Safety are really going to have to get together and figure out how they're going to arrange those transports and, you know, get folks out of here.
And he says what makes it extra hard is the Department of Corrections has also slashed the budget for community jails. Petersburg state funding will be cut a further third this year, from $320,000 to $185,000. So Swihart's put in a proposal which would limit the length of stay in Petersburg's jail to 9 days. That would make it even harder for the state troopers to get there on time.
Well, the cuts to the community jails has been a great concern of the Alaska State Troopers.
That's Colonel James Cockrell. He's the director of Alaska State Troopers. He says he's already seeing a backlash from police departments in small communities, as the troopers do not have the budget anymore to act as effectively in moving prisoners.
We are the face of state government, and we're the ones interacting with the local police departments, and we're the ones that's going to have to pick up the backload when they start reducing their services. We're starting to get an adversarial relationship with the small police departments.
And much of the issue here is about maintaining relationships. The Department of Corrections controls the budget for the jails, while the Department of Public Safety deals with the state troopers. Alaska state troopers are being told to cut a further $2.6 million this year. With both agencies making severe cuts, Cockrell says they will have to start to prioritize services.
There might be occasions where we're not going to have the manpower to make a transport, but more likely it'll happen is we'll make the transport and then the trooper won't be able to respond to a call for service.
And this is something that really concerns Kelly Swihart, but he thinks whatever happens, the community jails need to stay open.
The state needs to have a jail here. We need to have that type of facility here in Petersburg. Without that facility, we would have a negative impact on our quality of life, and it would negatively impact our public safety.
And for the time being, the jail here is safe. But Swihart says it may not be long before further cuts spell closing time for community jails across the state. In Petersburg, I'm Joe Sykes.
The Alaska Marine Highway System is proposing to scale back its schedule next year to save money. The state is holding public comment hearings today on the proposed schedule for next fall, winter, and spring. The Petersburg Borough Assembly has sent in a letter that the group approved on Monday. Here's more. The Petersburg Borough Assembly is sending a message to the state's ferry manager that the proposed schedule will affect commerce in the region as well as travel for Alaskans. The letter, crafted by Vice Mayor Cindy Lagadakis, says the ferry system is the highway system for Southeast Alaska. The letter asks how many other highways in the state charge such a toll.
It's what we need to move equipment and people and commerce.
Lagadakis says she has seen several studies on the ferry system show the same thing, that it's essential to Alaskans.
All of them identify that ferry ridership is primarily Alaska residents, that in the summertime there are more visitors in Southeast Alaska, but year-round, it really serves the Alaska residents more, and that it is an essential system. And I would consider it the same as our essential air service.
Petersburg Assembly Member John Haverlick said the ferry schedule could make or break it for local businesses of all sizes.
It's going to not only severely increase their cost with the suggested new system, but may end up doing away with a number of businesses that are struggling, you know, that without a decent system in place can't survive, which is going to hurt all of Southeast Alaska.
The borough letter also requests the state conduct a study during the next season to track ridership and cost effectiveness of each ferry voyage in Southeast, and then share the results with the region. Assemblymember Bob Lynn said he spent a lot of time looking at the proposed schedule and thinks it could be more efficient with its north and southbound routes out of Juneau.
One of my concerns was, and the reason I talked about the ridership, is when you look at Haines and Skagway and the number of ferry between Juneau and those communities versus those coming on south or going on, that's my concern.
The state has been requesting comments from the public. Assemblymember J. Stanton Greger encouraged others to put in their 2 cents.
It is our highway. Please advocate for it. We need it. Can't say it strongly enough. Please do.
The state oversees 11 ferries serving 35 communities along the southern part of the state. The public hearing for the southeast region starts at 10 a.m. For south central and southwest Alaska, it starts at 1:30 p.m. In other news, British Columbia officials are delaying permits for an open-pit mine near a river that flows into the ocean south of Ketchikan. They're saying Pacific Booker Minerals has not proved that it can keep toxic water out of nearby waterways. The developer says it has. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld has more.
Hi, I'm Joseph Kochoff with Investment Pitch Media. Today, we feature a company with a near-term production project located in northern British Columbia, Canada.
This YouTube video promotes the Morrison Project, owned by Vancouver-based Pacific Booker Minerals. It's about 200 miles east of Ketchikan.
PBM has completed a feasibility study and is proposing an open-pit mining and milling operation for the production of copper, gold, and molybdenum concentrate from the Morrison deposit.
The proposed mine site is in the watershed of the Skeena River, which enters the ocean about 50 miles south of the border. Juneau mine critic Chris Zimmer says Alaskans do catch fish out of the Skeena.
If we see crashes in salmon populations in rivers like that, it could affect Alaska's fishing. So even the rivers that don't flow right through southeast Alaska are still pretty important to our own fisheries here.
Pacific Booker turned down an interview request and answered only half the questions submitted in writing. But its website and documents filed with the province provide insight. The Morrison deposit was discovered by another company in the 1960s. Pacific Booker conducted exploratory drilling and began collecting information for its environmental permit about a dozen years ago. The company says it's identified deposits of copper, gold, and molybdenum. The proposed open-pit project, which is next to a lake, is within a dozen or so miles of two similar mines, which are closed. Pacific Booker says it's provided the information needed for British Columbia to issue permits required for construction to begin. BC's Mines and Environmental Agencies disagree.
We haven't said no, we haven't said yes. We've said you're heading in the right direction, but you have a lot more work you need to do before we can think about granting a permit.
BC Mines Minister Bill Bennett says the company has not proved the project design is foolproof. He says the province needs more information showing its tailing storage ponds won't leach polluted water into a nearby lake. Earlier this month, his agency and BC's environmental ministry told Pacific Booker to take another 3 years gathering that and other information.
We are the regulator. We tell the companies what they must do in order to earn their permits, and if the company can afford to hire the experts, the scientists, to provide the information, they do, and if they cannot afford to do that, then obviously you don't hear from them again.
But they will. Pacific Booker quickly issued a press release saying it's consulting with professional advisors, quote, on the best method to address the issues raised. That's likely to be legal action. The company sued the province after a 2012 permit application was rejected. That case went before British Columbia's Supreme Court, which ruled in its favor and sent the issue back to the government. Mines Minister Bennett says his agency will scrutinize permit applications for this and other mines that could affect Alaska fishermen. Critics on both sides of the border doubt that will happen.
How rigorous is that process going to be, or could this mine somehow slip through and the concern raised by BC over the past couple years not get addressed?
Rivers Without Borders' Chris Zimmer points to similar mines that won permits, such as the Red Chris in the Stikeen River watershed. Pacific Booker plans to use an earthen rock dam to contain tailings, which is waste rock from processing ore. That's the same type of dam that collapsed last year at Central British Columbia's Mount Polly.
You know, the BC permitting process is mine by mine, but right now there's no way really to answer the question, what happens if BC does put in a couple dozen of these mines over the next decades? What's the overall long-term effects of that?
The provincial government supports increased mine development and has added staff to speed the permitting process. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
And you can read about the Morrison and other mines that could impact Alaska fisheries through links posted on our website with this report. The federal government is stepping in to manage two of Alaska's most important historic sites after the legislature cut funding to state parks in Sitka. The National Park Service calls Castle Hill and Old Sitka cultural treasures and has agreed to take care of the parks at least through the fall. A third state-owned site, the popular Halibut Point Recreation Area, ultimately may be managed by the city. KCAW's Robert Woolsey has more from Sitka.
Sitka National Historical Park Superintendent Mary Miller says it's ironic that the park has scaled up storytelling around the Russian colonial presence in Sitka this year, since it's now going to be taking care of a larger piece of the former colony. But that's not the only irony in this agreement. The deal is good only through this fall, October 18th. That's the day in 1867 that Russia formally ceded Alaska to the United States in a flag-raising ceremony on Castle Hill, one of two sites in Sitka that the state has decided it can't afford to operate anymore.
Those are recognized as significant cultural and historic treasures, really, whose stories overlap with Sitka National Historical Park.
The other site, known as Old Sitka, is less celebrated than Castle Hill, but its role in the larger story of Alaska is far greater. The destruction of a Russian outpost there by the Sitka Tlingit in 1802 prompted a retaliatory strike by Alexander Baranov 2 years later, and he would subsequently move the headquarters of the Russian American Company and the capital of Russian America to Sitka. Modern Sitka is built right on the footprint of the Russian colonial capital, which was built over the historic Tlingit community with Castle Hill right at its center. Fitting this story together needs a better vantage point than can be found inside a museum.
And what you start to see by combining, say, the Russian Bishop's House, St. Michael's, the Blockhouse, Castle Hill, what we call Building 29, there are other aspects, too, of the cultural landscape, the Russian Cemetery, you start to really realize the cultural landscape that was here.
Starting back on July 1st, Miller and the National Park crew decided to step in as stewards of that cultural landscape. Sitka National Historical Park itself is a major feature of the downtown waterfront. Miller says her staff was positive about folding Castle Hill and Old Sitka into their responsibilities.
When we talked to the maintenance crew about this, and we've got a bigger crew this year than usual because of extra projects that we have ongoing at Sitka National Historical Park, they were actually pretty excited about it. They recognize that taking care of these sites is also a source of pride, just like it is for caretaking the assets at the regular park.
The National Park Service is not taking over management of Castle Hill and Old Sitka per se. Miller says it's more about maintenance. The NPS will remove trash, mow grass, blow leaves, clean trails, and brush out vegetation. And the Park Service is not going to be providing these services at the Old Sitka Boat Launch or at Halibut Point Recreation Area. Halibut Point, the Boat Launch, Fort Rousseau, and the Magoon Islands and Big Bear, Baby Bear State Marine Parks all went into so-called passive management when the state started its new budget year on July 1st. With the exception of Halibut Point, all of these sites are accessible only by boat and scarcely require maintenance of any kind. Halibut Point, however, is probably the most popular picnic beach in Sitka. Municipal Administrator Mark Gorman told the Assembly recently that passive management would likely lead to public safety issues.
It's very clear to me with the sudden closure of the state presence in the park that that issue is going to roll up to the city very rapidly. In fact, it did on Friday, with people coming and saying, I have a wedding plan there this week, I can't get in, who do I talk to?
Gorman said that City Hall was putting together a plan to care for Halibut Point for the Assembly's review at its next meeting. Meanwhile, the State Division of Parks is continuing to solicit proposals for the permanent care of Sitka's parks, which were defunded this spring, along with sites in Homer and Valdez. Despite the excellent overlap with the National Park Mission in Sitka, Superintendent Mary Miller sees her intervention as a stopgap measure.
So we're happy to step in, recognizing that the state is in need right now, and I'd like to think that if the tables were turned and that the federal government, for whatever reason, was short of resources, that we could look to the state and that they would step up and help us likewise.
Miller says the National Park Service will assess how well maintenance is going at Sitka State Parks this fall before she seeks additional funding for the program. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
And this wraps up KFSK's Midday Magazine. I'm Angela Denning. Thanks for listening.